VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Shadi Hamid, the author of the recently published book, Islamic Exceptionalism: How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Hamid is a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent think tank based here in Washington. In his book, Hamid argues that Islam, for a variety of cultural, historical, and theological reasons, is distinctive or exceptional in how it relates to politics. He discusses the three mainstream models of reconciling religion and the state, the traditional Muslim Brotherhood model, the AKP model in Turkey, and the Ennahda model in Tunisia. Hamid also harks back to the successful caliphates in Spain and the Ottoman Empire, arguing that since their dissolution, the struggle to establish a legitimate political order has raged on. A caliphate is the historical political entity governed by Islamic law and tradition, a concept being misappropriated and distorted by the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Before returning to Washington, he served as director of research at the Brookings Doha Center until January 2014. Shadi Hamid joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Carol. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
Islamic Exceptionalism. Now, you make two big arguments that Islam is different as it relates to politics, and that a replay of the Western model, that is, the so-called Protestant Reformation followed by Enlightenment, in which religion is pushed gradually into the private realm, is unlikely in the case of Islam. Please explain your arguments.
I mean, first of all religions are different from each other. So that kind of goes without saying. So I'm making a more specific argument that Islam is exceptional in a particular set of ways that have a profound impact, you know, really 14 centuries on. If we look at kind of the history of Islam, things that happened a very long time ago in terms of the founding and evolution of the religion still matter today. So it's a focus on the question of law, politics, and governance and how Islam relates to the state. And I also want to sort of challenge this idea that all peoples, cultures, and societies are basically the same, the idea that we all want the same things in the end. So oftentimes I'll hear from people, you know, hey, Shadi, you know, we Christians, we went through a lot of this too. We had a lot of violence, the 30 Years' War, the 100 Years' War. But you know what? We got there. You know, it takes time. It's a messy process and you'll get there too. But I think that kind of model of superimposing the experience of Christian Europe and the Reformation followed by Enlightenment followed by secularism, that's a problematic way of looking at things because it assumes that Islam will be sort of like Christianity. But Islam is not like Christianity.
Indeed, it is not. In fact, I would argue from what I've read that Islam is really more than a religion. It's a way of life. And in that vein, it is sort of similar to Judaism. Both faiths are governed by laws, in the case of Islam, Sharia, in the case of Judaism, Halakha, in contrast to Christianity, which is based on pure faith. So comparing Islam and Christianity isn't really apt.
Exactly. And I think that one thing to remember is that Jesus was a dissident against a reigning state. Jesus was never in a position to govern. So naturally, the New Testament is not going to say much about public law or politics. And Christians in the early centuries of Christianity were never a dominant majority where they could actually put their ideas into practice. But if you look at Islam, and this is where the figure of Prophet Muhammad is very important, Prophet Muhammad wasn't just a cleric, a theologian, or a prophet. He was also a politician. And not just that, he was a head of state. He was a state builder. So naturally, if Muhammad and the early Muslims are building a new state, the Quran has to have something to say about public law in a way that Christian scripture didn't. And I think the point you raise about Judaism is important, and that's where you see more comparisons. But even there, there are some important distinctions. So really, ever since the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 AD, Jews were never a majority governing their own state. So really, for almost 2,000 years, the rabbinical tradition evolves in a certain way where it's more about private practice, communal life, learning to live as minorities under the rule of others. And it's only really with the founding of the State of Israel that for the first time in really a millennium, that Jews have to sort of contend with this question of religion's relationship to the state in Israel.
Well, that's a very good point. And I would add, too, that Jews throughout the diaspora, after the destruction of the Second Temple, have fared much better under Muslim rule, whether in Spain, Al-Andalus, from around 700 to 1492, and even during the expulsion after the Reconquista, when Jews and Muslims, but Jews in particular, had to either convert or leave. So where did they go? They went to the Ottoman Empire, the lands of the previous Ottoman Empire, Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and then also North Africa. So it's very interesting. But you mentioned the State of Israel, and I do want to talk about the other models that you refer to in the book, but I thought we'd think outside the box just for a minute, notwithstanding the very important distinction you made about Jews being a minority in all of these lands, whether under Christians or Muslims. But now you have the State of Israel in 1948, and I'm wondering to what extent that might be a model of sorts for Muslims down the line in terms of how to combine or, you know, mix religion and politics. And I'm not referring to the policies of the government of Israel, which many Jews and the diaspora are in disagreement with, particularly with respect to the policies toward Palestinians or the West Bank. But I'm talking about how the Israelis have been able to be both a democracy and still have religion as an important guidepost.
Well, first of all, it would be hard to make the case to Muslims that Israel is an example to be emulated. So I think there's, you know, there's a built-in limitation there. But, you know, I think Israel as a modern state is a really interesting experiment because you see those tensions playing out really on a daily basis. But I think one important difference is that you don't really have far-right religious parties that have a chance to win elections outright. They have important influence and they're maybe part of coalition governments, but it's unlikely that they are going to dominate the way an Islamist party might dominate. And Islamist parties, as we know, have won free and fair elections in a number of different countries. And I think there's also an important difference, too, is Jews don't necessarily look back at a kind of golden era. There would be a debate about what that golden era is and which prophets or early Jews they're trying to emulate exactly. Obviously, Moses is an important figure, but I think what's really interesting about Islam is that, first of all, you have Prophet Muhammad, who Muslims, in theory and practice, like, love, admire, emulate. And even if you're not a very practicing Muslim, Muhammad still, there's something powerful about his example. But what I think is, it even goes just beyond that. You have the early era of the righteously guided caliphs, as they're called. And that's often seen as this original source of purity. This was the peak of Islamic success, of Islamic faith. This is when Muslims were really getting it right. And so what a lot of modern day Muslims will do, they'll look back to that period and there will be a lot of nostalgia and also this idea of copying exactly what the Prophet and his early followers did. And I don't think you see it in other religions quite to this extent. So just to give one example, you'll have modern day Salafis, ultra-conservative Muslims, who say, well, Prophet Muhammad didn't brush his teeth with a toothbrush, because of course there weren't toothbrushes back then. Prophet Muhammad used something called a miswak, which is a little branch. So you'll actually find some Salafis today, even in certain parts of the U.S., and you'll see them with a little twig. And so I think there's this idea of emulation, which some people obviously take very far.
It's a literal interpretation, which is just as bad, one could argue, as whether Christians or Jews were taking a literal interpretation of the Bible, whether the Old Testament in the case of Jews or the New Testament in case of Christians. That's not really accurate.
Yeah, and I should also really emphasize the majority of Muslims do not have that literalist approach where they're copying and pasting. That's just a minority. But you're getting to an interesting point about the difference between how Christians view the New Testament and how Muslims view the Quran. So you'll often hear far-right Christian evangelicals today say things like, the Bible is the word of God. And you'll hear Muslims say, the Quran is the word of God. But that's not quite the same thing. And this is really an important distinction that I highlight in the book. So where evangelicals will acknowledge that there were humans who wrote the Bible. So we know, of course, Paul, one of the disciples and founding figures of Christianity, wrote parts of the Bible. But Muslims will go one step beyond that. They'll say it's not just the word of God in some kind of general sense. The Quran is actually God's direct speech. In other words, every single letter and word in the Quran is coming directly from God. And that's important because if it's God's actual speech, you can't just dismiss the Quran or ignore it and say it's no longer relevant. You have to contend with it in a serious way because it's coming directly from God. And that's not just something that some Muslims believe. As a creedal requirement, that is really the foundation upon which so much of Islam rests. In some ways, it's similar to the idea that you couldn't have Christianity without Christ. Christ is the foundation, in some ways, of Christian theology. And it's similar in this respect that the Quran, as something coming directly from God, that is a foundational element.
Shadi Hamid, even though you say in the book that Islam cannot and should not necessarily reform in the way that some people say it should, have some sort of a reformation like Christianity did, but I would argue that Islam is definitely susceptible to various interpretations, not just this very narrow interpretation by the Salafis in particular, or, for example, the Wahhabi doctrine in Saudi Arabia. For example, like Judaism is open to interpretation. You have the Orthodox, but you have Reform interpretation, conservative. But also in the Muslim tradition, you have the Maliki tradition in Morocco, one would say very moderate, Sufi tradition in many countries, in stark contrast to this more literalist interpretation promulgated, for example, by Saudi Arabia. So how does that change the ability for a more tolerant, moderate, and sustainable political Islam?
So if you had five Muslims who all said they believed that the Quran was God's actual speech, you'd ask them, well, what does that actually mean in practice? How do you apply the Quran to the modern day? And those five Muslims would probably each say very different things. And this is really important that even if Muslims agree that the Quran is coming from God, they don't agree on how to interpret it, because the Quran was revealed in 7th century Arabia in a very different context. And how do you deal with modern day challenges like democracy, political parties, loans from the IMF? Like, there are things that the Quran doesn't really have much to say about, obviously. And that's why even if a majority of Muslims, say in Egypt or Jordan, say they believe that Islam should play a prominent role in public life, as the polling suggests, that doesn't mean they agree on what that role should be. And just because people believe in Sharia, and I think here, you know, here in the US and in Europe, whenever we hear the word Sharia, we automatically think it's a harsh or restrictive interpretation. But there can also be more progressive and pluralistic interpretations of Sharia. And I think it's really unfortunate that Sharia has become a kind of shorthand for badness. Sharia, bad.
Absolutely. And
then what you're getting at is really critical here, that there is a rich diversity in the classical Islamic tradition. You mentioned the different schools of Islamic law, but there's also different philosophical approaches. There are some that are more, let's say, spiritually inclined, like the Sufi traditions. So when I talk about Islam playing an outsized role in public life in this exceptional way, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be one thing or another. So if you go to Malaysia, Islam does play a prominent role in public life in a different way than Egypt. And in Egypt, it plays a different role than, say, Tunisia, because every country and context has its own local traditions where people are trying to bring Islam into the public sphere, but in a way that makes sense within the local context and culture, let's say.
Indeed, and we have many good examples in sub-Saharan Africa, Senegal, yeah. Nigeria. We'll be back in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Shadi Hamid, author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. He's a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Gode Shehu from Jos Plateau State in Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'll back to our guest, Shadi Hamid, to talk about your book, Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. Well, Shadi Hamid, we've talked a lot about Islam, politics. Let's talk about some of the models you discuss in the book, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the AK Party in Turkey, and Nahda in Tunisia. First to the Muslim Brotherhood, which was what they started in 1924. Talk about the evolution, how the Muslim Brotherhood changed or didn't from its inception in 1924 to date, particularly when the Muslim Brotherhood gained power in Egypt after the uprising.
Yeah, so the Brotherhood is sort of the mother of all Islamist movements. And obviously, Egypt is also the most populous Arab country. So the Egyptian Brotherhood has a kind of stature. And I think that it's been sort of fascinating, but also in some ways depressing to watch, first of all, what's happened in Egypt, but also to look at how there was a military coup against the democratically elected Muslim Brotherhood government that was led by Mohamed Morsi in 2013. So the Brotherhood, for a long time, they never really thought they had a real chance to govern. It seemed so far out into the future, but then the Arab Spring happens, and here they are thrust into this new position, and they find themselves woefully unprepared. Because it's one thing to be an opposition movement, it's quite another to actually govern a country as unwieldy as Egypt. But I think what we really saw in Egypt was the fact that some of the most basic questions about the modern nation state remain unresolved. So under dictators, all of these very difficult conversations about the role of religion in public life were suppressed because people weren't able to express themselves freely. The Arab Spring happens, and all of these suppressed identities are being expressed by different sides across the political and ideological spectrum. And I think what we realize in Egypt is that Muslims in many of these countries have not been able to resolve in any basic way the question of Islam's relationship to the state. And these are very raw and existential issues because an Egyptian's relationship to Egypt is a very personal thing. How you relate to your own state, what it means to be Egyptian, the meaning and nature of the nation state. Should this state be ideologically or religiously neutral, or should this state promote a particular conception of religion? And those are things that are going to have to be worked out. How do you split the middle on identity or religion? You can split the middle on economic issues because there are numbers and you can literally split the middle, right? But if it's something to you that is so personal and it's either one thing or another, then it leads to politics being a zero-sum game. So one thing I talk about in the book is that the fact that, and this is a bit crazy, weird, fascinating, and frightening to me, is I have relatives in Egypt who not only supported the 2013 coup against the Brotherhood, but they all supported the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history, which happened a month later, where about 1,000 Muslim Brotherhood supporters were killed in broad daylight when the security forces moved in. So it's an interesting sort of puzzle, is how do otherwise good people, like my relatives, people who are dear to me, how they can come to support these things? And that's why I think understanding the role that religion plays and how it arouses these very strong and sharp and existential passions is really important. So for me, going forward, the way to address this is not to force Islamists. And speaking as an American now, you know, we don't have to like groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. We can disagree with them on any number of issues, and they don't believe in the things that I, as an American, believe in. But I think that one thing I really want to get across in this book is that you can't force people to be something they don't want to be. You can't repress people into being secular or liberal. So even if we think that's the ideal state and we wish that Muslims will become liberal and go through an enlightenment and all that, you can't force people to do that.
There's a distinction to be made between liberal and pluralist, for example. One could argue that Mohamed Morsi, notwithstanding being elected, he was as repressive, if not more repressive, than Hosni Mubarak. So people perhaps were just really angry and upset about what they perceived as Muslim Brotherhood basically abusing power. Now, one could argue they could have waited till the next election, but perhaps those that were against him, including some of your relatives, just were afraid that they would not leave power. So there's that concern on the part of those who are worried about Islamist parties, that they'll accept the rules of democracy, you know, as long as they get elected. But after that, they will not accept leaving power according to the rule of law.
Yes, the Brotherhood did not govern inclusively. And I actually got to know Mohamed Morsi a little bit before he became president. And this is the last guy you wanted to be in charge of Egypt. I mean, he wasn't a particularly impressive person. And I think in many ways, being president was a surprise to him as well. So yes, the Brotherhood didn't govern inclusively. They made a lot of mistakes, but they weren't as repressive as Mubarak. And they're certainly not as repressive as Sisi is today. People were allowed to protest. People were forming political parties. And we know that people were able to express themselves to some extent because, you know, millions of people came out to protest against Morsi on June 30th, 2013. And there was also a sense that, as you said, they could have waited until the next election, parliamentary elections. And I think that's what it really comes down to. Even if you hate groups that are elected, and the Brotherhood was democratically elected in this case, the best thing to do is to make your case that they are not good for the country and hope that enough of your fellow countrymen agree with you come the next election.
All right. The very few minutes we have left,
yeah, sure.
I do want to move on to other countries. But I think one important point to make is that what we're seeing, whether in Egypt or perhaps even in Tunisia, we're going from very secular regimes where the military is very dominant to sometimes the other extreme. And the problem is, where's the middle? And it's because so many of these countries were authoritarian that the middle was what they feared the most, a more liberal or pluralistic expression, people subscribing to pluralistic ideals and democracy. They actually are more threatening than, let's say, the other extreme. So they create these false choices, let's say a Mubarak in Egypt. Well, if it's not me, it's going to be a radical political Islamist. And in reality, they have suppressed the evolution of a middle ground. And the West hasn't perhaps done enough to perhaps foment or foster that middle group. But let's talk to Tunisia. To what extent it's a more promising model? You have the Ennahda party looking perhaps to be a more promising model, collaborating, compromising with other parties.
Yeah, so Tunisia, look, oftentimes it's really hard to say anything optimistic when we're having these conversations about the Middle East. And that's why Tunisia is important, because in some ways it is the lone bright spot. And I think there the lesson is Islamists and secularists in Tunisia, they don't like each other. In some cases, they hate each other. But they agreed to hate each other within the context of a peaceful political process. They didn't resort to violence against each other. So for me, that's the very important lesson, that I'm under no illusions that we're all going to believe in the same things. And why should we? And I think Islamists and their opponents in the Middle East have fundamentally different visions of what they want their countries to look like. And that's also the case for Tunisia. But then the key then is exactly a word that you've honed in on, which is pluralism, that we don't have to like each other, but we have to find a way to live with each other and try to resolve our differences through national dialogue. So if I really had a message then for listeners who are trying to understand, well, what do we do about the role of Islam in public life? I think part of it is coming to terms with it and finding a way to accommodate it in a way that doesn't threaten the rights of others. And that's really where pluralism should become the focus. Now, Tunisia, I think looking forward, there are darker undercurrents because Tunisia has contributed the largest number of foreign fighters per capita to ISIS. And sometimes, you know, we like to sort of not look at that part of it. And this is why democratic transitions are messy and complicated. They lead to instability because people have very high expectations after the revolution, but those expectations are almost never met. So you hope that as the transition in Tunisia proceeds and as democracy becomes more safe and secure, you know, we'll start to see Tunisia presenting an even better model, let's say. Although I don't like the word model because whenever we call something a model, we're almost like tempting fate and it starts to go downhill. I mean, look at the Turkish model, for example. So let's say that Tunisia can be a positive template.
Okay, good word. Well, speaking of Turkey in the very few minutes, Turkey was a model, let's say a template for Rashid Ghannouchi, the head of Ennahda in Tunisia. And Turkey, for so many years, was doing very well under the Justice and Development Party, known as the AK Party, under Recep Tayyip Erdogan. But we're seeing, you know, a move toward so much authoritarianism, a power grab. To what do you attribute the way Turkey is going under Recep Tayyip Erdogan? Would you say it's more of a manifestation of a man who is perhaps obsessed with power, with control, because of the amount of repression we're seeing, particularly in the aftermath of the attempted coup in July and the repression of those who he believes support Fethullah Gulen, whom he accuses as having instigated the coup. But we're seeing, even before that, a clampdown on the press, on freedom of expression. You know, again, I think it's important we don't conflate the trajectory of democracy in Turkey with the man himself.
Turkey, in this sense, is a little bit depressing because they have had decades of democratic experience. So it's not as if they just started doing this, right? But this really, I think, highlights the danger of coups because Turkey's first coup was in 1960, and then there were several coups after that. Once you set the precedent that the military, acting as sort of this guardian of the state, can step in and stop the democratic process, then they feel empowered to do that in the future. So I think that you hope that Turkey has moved away from that legacy, but of course there was the failed coup attempt in July, and it was good that the coup didn't succeed, but it was bad in a sense because even when coups fail, they contribute to a lot of paranoia. They provoke the target of the coup to act more aggressively and to preside over these large-scale purges that Erdogan has been doing, as you mentioned. So I think that the hope is that somehow Erdogan will be reined in, but I don't think that looks very promising now because Turkey is in this wave of nationalist feeling after the coup, and a lot of Turks have rallied to the side of Erdogan. It raises an interesting question of what does Turkey look like 10 or 15 years down the road? And there's a very interesting debate of, you know, is Erdogan doing what he's doing because he has this thirst for power? Or is it because he's being motivated by religion? And I think in some ways it's a mix. But I think dismissing the role of religion can be problematic. Why does Erdogan want power? Why does that matter to him? Because he's trying to undo the Kemalist legacy of past decades where Turkey was kind of, you know, under a system of forced secularization. And that has led to a lot of bitterness, not just with Erdogan, but with his millions of supporters who weren't able to freely express their religious beliefs. And now a lot of them want revenge, and that's the scary part. And that's what the kind of the bitterness you see in Turkish politics can lead to. And I think the way that Erdogan sees it, he wants to be remembered as a world historical figure on par with the founder of modern Turkey, Atatürk. So I think he's going to want to leave the scene changing and transforming Turkey. And I think that this is the dangerous part of any political process when you have a strong leader who uses a very strong centralized state, and Turkey is a very strong state, to then reshape society. And we'll have to wait and see if he ends up being successful in that regard.
The book is Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. The author, Shadi Hamid, senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution. Shadi Hamid, congratulations on your book, and thank you so much for a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Carol, for having me. My pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rob McLean. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.